Committee for Thursday, March 31st, 2005, and open a hearing on House Bill 5044, Department of Justice. We are continuing with completion of any public testimony for those who were unable to provide testimony on yesterday. And then we're also going to wrap up the agency's presentation with a discussion from the Honorable Hardy Myers, Attorney General. Anyone signed up?
Madam Chair, the only person we are carrying over for a public testimony is Ms. Botkin, who I do not see in the audience.
Okay. Then we will move forward and ask our good Attorney General to come forward. And good afternoon.
Madam Chair. For the record, Hardy Myers, Attorney General, and thank you for the opportunity to make a few closing comments to this stage of your review of our budget.
I apologize to you, Mr. Attorney General, that we do not have a quorum of members present to hear your wrap-up.
They are not missing very much, Madam Chair.
That I guess.
I wish they were. I would first like to extend thanks, and I am sorry they're not here to hear this. Thanks to the subcommittee for its very courteous and professional treatment of the members of the Department of Justice. I assure you, Madam Chair, that's much appreciated by my colleagues, and we want to extend thanks for that. Before I talk briefly about the general fund reductions in the governor's budget, I wanted to note briefly that yet ahead for discussion and decision is the issue of the hourly billing rate for the department's legal services during 2005-2007, a tremendously important decision. I just make a couple of comments at this time, Madam Chair. One is that we have, as I think we have done each biennium, I've had experience with the process, we have worked very closely with the Legislative Fiscal Office and Mr. Wilson to try to bring the rate down to the lowest level we feel it can be responsibly brought to. And secondly, that the process of determining the rate is a very transparent, it's a very transparent calculation. It's not just a number thrown up on the wall. Every dollar of the rate has a footing in an identified set of costs that account for it being in the rate. That isn't to say that some committee might not decide to change it, but only that it's not an arbitrary calculation. It is very, very precisely determined. And finally, that the dominant driver of biennium to biennium adjustments in the rate, Madam Chair, are changes in the cost of personal services. The rate has held basically static between last and this biennium because personnel costs were held basically static with the compensation freeze. But for the coming biennium, presumably that is going to be changing, and the rate reflects that. And so the only thing I would say about that is that we would like to just have parity with other agencies in terms of what of the additional costs this coming biennium for personal services are we going to be allowed to recover in the rate, and to the extent we're not, we would like that to look the same for all the government. We don't expect to be able to recover more of those costs than other agencies, but we would like to be able to be treated equivalently.
Certainly.
To the general fund for just a few moments, Madam Chair. I wish, of course, that the governor's budget did not include any general fund reduction recommendations, but it does. I am not taking with the subcommittee the position that you should not, must not make this or that reduction because this is a zero-sum game, and I don't have an answer for you as to where you would get the money to make a particular restoration. As to the general fund component of our budget, therefore, at this point, Madam Chair, my basic hope is that, one, the subcommittee would not choose to deepen any of the cuts, the general fund cuts that are in the governor's recommended budget, and that you would endorse the governor's recommendation for the full funding of the Division of Child Support Program. That recommendation is not without reason, as I think has been made clear. There's a tremendous leveraging effect of every dollar of investment in that program, not only in terms of the matching federal funds, but then the resulting benefits for every dollar invested of activity. And I'm very proud as we informed the subcommittee that our program's performance in that regard is among the 10 highest in the country. So, as to the reductions that are in the governor's budget, Madam Chair, I do not know whether the process you engaged in will ultimately produce some amount of funds that this subcommittee will have the decision to reinvest differently from the governor's budget, whether your process of reviewing the budgets in your jurisdiction will create savings that you will be able to differently apply than the governor's budget requests recommends. If and to the extent that occurs, and if and to the extent the subcommittee believes that any of those funds should be applied to avoid in whole or in part some of the reductions in the governor's budget, my own sense of the priorities for that, Madam Chair, would be, number one, the Defense of Criminal Convictions Program, which I think has emerged as the third highest priority, both in terms of our submissions as well as the scoring of the subcommittee. And bearing in mind that we are talking in relation to that program of convictions, these are men and women who have been convicted of offenses. Secondly, the criminal fines and assessment account reduction, first, and the conversion of it to the general fund. Again, I very respectfully hope the legislature will decide not to move those funds into the general fund in toto and abandon the public safety fund structure. I think that the fact these funds are raised from assessments on criminal offenders makes it entirely appropriate that some part of them be, in effect, dedicated to go back to the service of law enforcement and victims. And that is now achieved through the Public Safety Fund. Within the reductions of the criminal fines and assessment account allocations to the Department of Justice, I think that the most sensitive of those reductions is the Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Program. I think the sexual abuse of children is the most deplorable form of criminal conduct. And I think that the Oregon program to respond to that, Madam Chair, is one that we can be very, very proud of. I think it is a national model. And I think the preservation of the quality of that program and its ability to respond to abused children is of tremendous importance to this state. And then the Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Victims Services Fund, closely in tandem, I think, in importance, the preservation of that fund's ability to help nourish and sustain these important programs assisting victims of those two forms of criminal misconduct, its importance, I think, goes without saying. A final comment, Madam Chair, separate comment on consumer protection, which, as you know, is not presently general fund supported. And the withdrawal of that general fund by the legislature has created the situation we face in the coming biennium, which we've graphically reviewed for the subcommittee. I think it's very important that the subcommittee keep in mind that consumer protection is a civil law enforcement program, and it is about victims. It is about victims, albeit not, for the most part, of person crimes, but it's still about victims whose lives can be significantly impacted by the kind of misconduct that that program addresses. And it's also not just about individuals, particularly senior citizens, it's also about businesses as victims as well. Mm-hmm. And I think the law-abiding business community has a tremendous stake in the ability to try to work toward effective responses to law violations in the economy. We would, of course, welcome some restoration of general funds. But to be truthful, Madam Chair, as I have thought about this further, at best, I think the general fund represents a very shaky foundation upon which to build part of this program. We're going to be indefinitely facing claims against the general fund, which are well in excess of the legitimate needs of the state. And I've come to the conviction, Madam Chair, that what needs to happen is the formation of a bipartisan House-Senate coalition of members who are united in the view that the preservation of the strength of this program is of high public importance, very important quality of life issue, and which coalition and I pledge to work very, very closely myself with this effort. This coalition is committed to trying to identify this session an alternative and relatively stable and predictable funding source for this program that can supplement the revolving account. As I said, I think that is the way to try to resolve on a longer term basis the predicament that we're facing. And I certainly pledge to you, Madam Chair, my office's full energy in attempting to work through to an ultimate identification of that alternative longer term answer. Again, Madam Chair, thank you very much for the subcommittee's courtesy. We look forward to returning for the billable rate discussion and for your considerations of the budget thereafter, and certainly at any time if more information is needed from the department, I trust you'll let us know.
Attorney General Myers, thank you very much for those very thoughtful comments, and I also commit to you to work with you and help in identifying that bipartisan group of legislators that you referenced who can work in the way that you have defined and described. I look forward to working with you in that way. I will also urge other members of the subcommittee to pay very close attention to your closing remarks and to look for those in the record, the written record, as well as the audio record. And again, thank you very much for
your
presentation today. What I'd like to do is go back to public testimony. And Ms. Botkin, good afternoon. I know we had you signed up yesterday, and you were very gracious about being willing to come back and testify today.
Thank you. Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Mary Botkin, and I'm here today representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. We have the distinct honor and indeed the pleasure of representing the Assistant Attorney Generals that work for Attorney General Myers. I want to say just a couple of things. These are people who, by and large, are the best and the brightest that this state has to offer. And they are, for the lack of a better analogy, they're sort of our last line of defense in a system that culminates oftentimes at the Attorney General's desk. And, you know, I listened yesterday very carefully to sort of each division as they were testifying and talking about the different challenges that they were facing. And as you know, Madam Chair, we represent a range of public safety officials from 911 through parole and probation at both the adult and the juvenile level. And I just want to encourage you to think of this system as sort of a balloon that when you push on one side, it bulges on the other. And so, you know, when we look at what the Attorney General has laid out as his priorities, we certainly don't have any monumental disagreements with those priorities at all. And I think that it's very challenging trying to identify how you would prioritize a budget that's been cut year after year in an environment where, if you will, there's not very much that's very sexy about this part of the law. You know, this is sort of where the rubber meets the road. These folks work very hard. You know, one of the things that wasn't touched on very heavily yesterday was the influx of ballot measures. Mm-hmm. I mean, these folks have to review every ballot title. That's not very exciting work, but it's certainly work that has to be done. And it is time-consuming. If there is a message that we would give the subcommittee, our concern as their union is our ability to hold on to the attorneys that we have, to recruit new attorneys to replace those who retire or move into private practice, and I would be remiss if I did not say that we have some concerns about the caseloads. You know, we would like to see more attorneys, more staff attorneys, to just get the work done. You know, when I look at the challenges that you will be facing, I think that it's time for us to ask how we're going to fund these very different pieces of state government that are so critical, whether it is through, you know, criminal convictions. If we don't do that well, then it falls back on the DAs. If the DAs don't do their job well, then it falls on the courts. This is a very challenging area. There's no easy answers. And, you know, I'm going to be here with you a lot, making these same arguments for each one of our budgets. I decided years ago that I wasn't going to play one budget off against another, that I argue the merits of each budget. And this budget is as important to us as every other piece of the budget. And the folks who work at the Attorney General's office are critical to the entire criminal justice structure and to the sanctity of our constitutional law in Oregon. I don't know how you can prioritize domestic violence over violence against children or vice versa. That's why you're sitting on that side of the desk and I'm not. You know, you are my state senator, and I don't envy you these decisions, but I do think that the committee is going to have to work their way through this and decide how they're going to prioritize these pieces inside a budget. You know, unfortunately, some of these pieces don't have strong advocates to come in and argue for them. There's not a lot of people who are going to come in and argue for the defense of criminal convictions. But we will, because we think that that's every bit as important as every other piece of the budget that these folks do. And I just want to say that we have found working with Attorney General Myers delightful. As you know, he lives in our neighborhood. He's our neighbor, you know. But beyond that, he is a man filled with integrity, and that's what you look for in a good attorney general. Hopefully, because of his leadership, this state will never see a Terry Schiavo argument. You know? He's been very good at defending us against, or defending our death with dignity statutes. And I think that, you know, we know what to do in Oregon, and it's thanks to folks like Attorney General Myers and the staff attorneys that work with him that this has happened, and that we have been able to preserve sort of our end-of-life processes in a dignified and manageable way that will not lead us through years and years of court battles that make no sense. And so it's with that that we support this budget with enhancements. You know, our attorneys want a raise. You know, they're way below market. You know, we don't even have to go there. But mostly these folks have made a choice of public service, not because the money's good, not because the benefits are great, but because they get to do some things that you don't get to do if you're working in private practice. And I think that's important, and they should be rewarded. And again, we would support the budget with enhancements, and we offer any support we can to the subcommittee in trying to find additional funds, because we want a lot more money to come to this subcommittee, okay? Just generally speaking. Thank you. And I'd be happy to answer any questions, though I can't imagine that you have any of me, because I am not certified smart in constitutional and or legal issues. I just know what those folks do across the street, and I'm proud of them for doing it. Thank you.
As are we. And thank you very much for your presentation, and also thank you for your patience. I am going to close the hearing on House Bill 5044 and opening a hearing on Senate Bill 5523, Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, and invite forward Mr. Michael Washington, Board Chair, and Linda Gilbert, Budget and Management Division. And good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Ms. Gilbert, would you like to begin?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. For the record, Linda Gilbert, Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management. I am working from the document that looks like this. And the idea of this is to do a very high-level context of the budget, the public safety budget, and the Board of Parole budget as it fits within that. Moving to page 2, there is a public safety program area context picture, display. On the left side, we see that we have $2.4 billion, all funds or total funds in the public safety program area, and that represents about 5.7% of the total state budget. The Board of Parole's portion of that is 0.1% at $3.4 million. On the right side, we have general fund and lottery fund statewide for the public safety program area is $1.6 billion. That's about 13% of the total state budget in general fund and lottery. Board of Parole has 0.2% of that amount, again, at $3.4 million. The next page addresses the governor's principal's budget and simply says that the parole board's budget is entirely included in the principle related to public safety, which is that Oregonians are safe in their homes, communities, and in state institutions. The next four pages present four different views of the same budget. We'll look at it from a fund type view, a program view, a budget category view, and a historical view. Starting with page 4, this is the fund type view, and there is not a lot to show there. 99.9% of the fund for this agency is general fund. The rest, some $9,500, is raised to support the cost to provide public document copies and records in response to public requests. On page...
Representative Wisnat.
Thank you. Mrs. Gilbert, can you tell me why in the bill does it say we... The maximum limit that we can collect in fees is 95. Why do we put a maximum limit? If we sell more, we get more. I don't understand. In Section 2 of the bill, it says the amount of $9,517 is established as the maximum level of, for payment of expenses for fees.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnat, that is simply the language that is used to limit expenditures. It doesn't limit revenue. If they suddenly have lots and lots more orders and more revenue,
thank you.
We probably play with the limitation.
Madam Chair, that is standard language for all other funds.
Okay, I understand it now because it's not expenditure. Not you can take in more, just can't spend them. Gotcha.
Moving to page 5, this is the program view. Since there is only one program, 100% of the funding is in that program, and it's called the general program. Later on, you'll get more detail about the functions that occur within that program. The next page, page 6, shows the budget by budget category. There are only two categories that this agency uses. About 60% of their budget is in personal services. Around 40% of the budget is in services and supplies. In the services and supplies, about half of that, just under half of that, is for AG expenses. The next 24% would be professional services, 19% state government service charges, and the rest of it is pretty much all other office supplies and miscellaneous, that sort of thing.
Okay. Representative Wisnat.
Would you please go to those figures again? I was not fast enough. The AG.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnat. AG is about 49% of the services and supplies budget. And professional services, 24%. I was going to do that from memory, but I can't. State government service charges, 19%. Office expenses, that falls to 4%. And then the rest of it is about another 4%, and that's for all the rest of the services and supplies charges.
Thank you very much.
On the following page, page 7. This is a history view of the board's budget, starting with 1999-01 actuals at $2.9 million, rising a little in 01-03 and 03-05, and finally in the 05-07 governor's budget, the total is $3,431,922. This is a 5.7% increase over 03-05 legislatively approved. The major components of the 5.7% increase are personal service increases, and part of that would be that the PERS rate is up from about 10.7% to a little over 15%. Flex benefits are in there at $771 a month. Pension obligation bond debt service is a component of that. State government service charges are actually down 13%, and AG costs are up 16%. And that would be what drives that increase. On page 8, we discuss policy issues. This budget is basically a flat budget. It keeps the agency operating pretty much as it is operating now. It assumes no changes in sentencing, any law having to do with releasing inmates, and it makes no changes in current workload. The cost drivers, of course, are the number of offenders on post-prison supervision, and the number of offenders subject to prison release hearings. I've listed 1,300, and those would be the pre-1989 offenders. There are also dangerous offenders and offenders incarcerated for aggravated murder that would bring that total up to about 1,600 that would get that kind of a hearing. And then, as discussed on the previous page, inflation on personal services and services and supplies is another cost driver. On the last page, fee or revenue issues, there are none for this agency. There are technical adjustments, and I think my boss, Mr. Friels, pointed out to you a few days ago that a technical adjustment is, oops, we found an error. So this is something that we will be asking for your consideration of when we get to a work session point in this. This has a couple of pieces. The request is to shift funds from services and supplies to personal services to cover a couple of shortfalls. One is that one of the board members was appointed after a freeze on the salary rate had been assigned to the budget. The appointment was at the top step of the salary rate. The budget was at the second step, and there's a gap there that needs to be made up. The other one is to restore 0.25 full-time equivalent record specialist position to bring that to a full-time position. This is a person who is responsible for managing some 26,000 records. This person's job interfaces with Department of Justice to make sure that they have records that they need, among other things. The total cost of that will be some $65,000. And it will be provided, as I said, from services and supplies. Actually, it's about two-thirds of the inflation on the Attorney General budget that they have. And that concludes my presentation.
Comments or questions for Ms. Gilbert? Mr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, we usually give a presentation at this time. In fact, the memo is sitting on my desk. I forgot to make copies of it. Mm-hmm. But the only thing it would likely add, and I hope Mr. Washington does talk a little bit about this, is the Supreme Court decision, the recent one on predatory sex offenders, the impact that that might have on your budget and operations. Okay. I think that's probably the only other issue that I would have raised that Ms. Gilbert did not raise. This is a pretty straightforward budget. Has really no policy packages or program changes, and it is likely
based, of course, on what the subcommittee chair desires, but probably will be the first budget you work session in this subcommittee.
Representative Wisnoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doug, reviewing your paper you gave us back at the beginning, the thing I see with this agency, however, is that it's a big change in their mission. Is this 1989, now they're doing just the case planning and things like that. So that's a big change. Does that involve different expertise? I mean, is the personnel positions, should they be looked at as far as reclassification? We're down to, 1,200 people that they're really looking at for parole, I think, wasn't it? Or 1,400 now.
Representative Wizard, I'm sure the board chair will talk a little bit about the history, but that change actually has been sort of evolving for a number of years. So that, I mean, if you look back a few years, the parole board had, I'm not sure what the maximum number of members were, but it was more than the three they currently have, and it has turned from the traditional parole board that you used to see on TV and other places to more of a much different operation that I think Mr. Washington
will
talk about.
Mr. Wilson, I would ask you to hand out now the article from today's Oregonian regarding, look at the title again, titled Parole System Ineffective and Halting Rearrest Study Says. This is a study that the state of Oregon participated in, and I'm going to ask Mr. Washington to comment on this article if you feel comfortable doing that. You're just finding out today that we have an interest in hearing your perspective, but you reached the appropriate moment. If you could weave in some comments, that would be helpful.
Okay.
And good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. I'm Michael Washington, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Michael Washington. I'm Chair of the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 5523, which is the budget bill for the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. And I'm going to be testifying out of this book, the Board's presentation notebook, and it has a table of contents in it, and I will be following through that the direction that the table of contents and way the presentation is laid out, and the pages, I'll direct you to the pages that I'm going to talk about. With me today here are Aaron East, the Board's Executive Director, and Board Member Darcy Baker. In the way that the table of contents is laid out, is first going through the phase one. That's listed as phase one, and we start out with the board's statutory authority and its mission. And the board's statutory authority is found in Chapter 144 of the Oregon Revised Statutes and the Oregon Administrative Rules, Chapter 255. And under the authority of both of those chapters and divisions, the board imposes prison terms and makes parole decisions on offenders whose criminal conduct occurred prior to November 1st, 1989, or those who have been sentenced as dangerous offenders, or for murder and aggravated murder, and are eligible for release on to either parole or post-prison supervision. For these offenders, the board has the legal authority to decide when the inmate is released from prison, and when these inmates are released to the community, they are ordered to serve a term of post-prison supervision or parole. Parole is a period of supervision in the community that is following the release from prison. But with those offenders that are convicted of murder and aggravated murder or dangerous offenders, that the board has release authority over, those offenders would be on post-prison supervision. They could be on either parole or post-prison supervision. For most of the crimes that committed on or after November 1st, 1989, the sentencing court in the Department of Corrections, using statutory guidelines, established the length of the prison terms. The board does not determine the release date for these inmates, and when these inmates are released to the community, they are ordered to serve a term of post-prison supervision. A post-prison supervision is a sentence of correctional supervision in the community following a prison or a jail sentence, and a court determines how long that period should be, and the board determines which conditions that the offender must comply with when they're out in the community serving a post-prison supervision. Finally, the board has several statutory responsibilities for all inmates released from prison, and regardless of when they committed their crimes, the board is legally required to order that these offenders comply with conditions of parole or post-prison supervision, issue arrest warrants when the offenders violate their conditions of supervision or abscond supervision, impose sanctions for violations of those conditions of supervision, and determine whether discharge from parole supervision is compatible with public safety and or required by Oregon law. The board also registers crime victims, responds to inquiries concerning offenders, and notifies victims and law enforcement, district attorneys, and judges about the release of offenders. And moving on to page two, our mission is to work in partnership with the Department of Corrections and local supervisory authority to protect the public and reduce the risk of repeat criminal behavior through incarceration and community supervision decisions based on applicable laws, victims' interests, public safety, and recognized principles of offender behavioral change. The agency, the strategic goals and our guiding principles for our decisions are to protect the public, reduce the risk of repeat criminal behavior, value the victim's interests, ensure legal integrity, and value our partnerships with our stakeholders. In addressing the historical perspective of the board consisting of three members was established in 1911, and in 1915 the board was increased to five members, one of which was a parole officer who was responsible for enforcing the conditions of parole and returning violators to prison. In 1939, the probation cases were added to the board's responsibilities, and by 1951 the State Board of Parole and Probation had three field offices. The governmental reorganization in 1969 resulted in the board having three full-time members. The newly created Corrections Division was given responsibility to supervise field parole and probation staff and to retake and return parole and probation violators. And in 1975, the board was again expanded to five members. And in 1977, the board developed ranges of imprisonment to determine parole eligibility dates, and that's known as the matrix system. And from July 1983 through September 1984, 6,033 hearings were conducted by the board for inmates to set the prison terms or to decide which dates these offenders should be released onto parole. And in 1989, when the legislature adopted the sentencing guidelines, the name of the board was changed from the Board of Parole to Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. This new law changed the way sentences were imposed for felonies, except with respect to those sentences, dangerous offenders or for aggravated murder, and now for murder. Parole was abolished for crimes committed after November 1, 1989. In 1991, board membership was changed to at least three, but no more than five members. And during the 1990s, the legislature adopted a community corrections philosophy and allocated funds for local law enforcement and corrections agencies to take more responsibility for housing and supervising convicted criminals. Local jurisdictions were given responsibility, including post-prison supervision, for persons sentenced for 12 months or less. The State Corrections Division retained responsibility for inmates sentenced to more than 12 months, and the board retained jurisdiction for the post-prison supervision of these offenders. Recently, the legislature instructed the state and local corrections agencies, including the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, to jointly adopt rules covering inmates and offenders on parole and post-prison supervision. In 1997, the legislature authorized the board to review sanctions for post-prison supervision violations and impose sanctions in some circumstances. Today, the board has three members. We are actively involved in our partnerships with the Department of Corrections and community corrections agencies throughout the state. We communicate directly with supervising officers daily regarding the management of offenders on supervision in the community. And we provide formal training to supervise officers and prison counselors and hearing officers, and we regularly communicate with crime victims about the release and supervision of offenders in the community. The next section in the presentation deals with the program overview and our target groups.
The board is not divided into divisions due to its size, and we're considered one program. However, within our one program, we have identified three sub-programs with nine corresponding major functions, which are either statutorily required or necessary to support a statutory function.
Parole, release, and community supervision is a program comprised of many steps or processes in a single system to legally and effectively authorize the release of an inmate from jail or prison and provide oversight and tools for effective supervision in the community. One step in this process cannot be removed from the system in order for the other parts of the system to function properly. These processes are completed in partnership with the Department of Corrections. Going to page 4. And county community corrections agencies to protect the public and reduce the risk of repeat criminal behavior. This program in the governor's recommended budget costs $1,847,836 and is comprised of 9.25 full-time employees. Administrative review is a program necessary to allow an inmate or offender's legal right to appeal a board action or a decision. This program in the governor's recommended budget costs $877,542 and is comprised of 1.25 full-time employees. Legal and administrative support is a program that updates policies, administrative rules, and statutory changes, communicating changes to our criminal justice stakeholders. Additionally, is comprised of the necessary staff and resources to support the operations of our legally mandated functions and to operate as a state agency. This program in the governor's recommended budget costs $706,544 and is comprised of 4.25 full-time employees. As the board carries out its programs, it interacts with several interest groups and serves many customers, and they are as follows. In the interest groups, we have community corrections, parole and probation officers statewide, crime victims organizations, the Department of Corrections, the Department of Justice, the Oregon Association of Community Correction Directors, the Sex Offender Supervision Network, and various public safety committees. In our customers, we have the crime victims, family and friends of offenders, parole and hearings officers, Department of Corrections staff, and the general public. On pages 6 and 7, you will find the board's organizational charts. And as indicated earlier, the board currently consists of three full-time board members who have primary responsibility for carrying out agency programs, including all of our statutory responsibilities. Additionally, board members attend meetings and conduct hearings statewide to maintain partnerships with community corrections and others with whom we do business. The chair of the board performs the duties of a board member, oversees all of the board's functions, participates in hearings and meetings statewide, and serves on various committees to assist the legislature and other agencies on issues relating to public safety. The board has 11 staff members who process the various orders issued by the board or provide support for the ongoing daily activities of the board. The board's executive director manages the day-to-day operations of the agency, providing direct administrative support to the chair, including budget and fiscal management, supervision of all represented staff, and the board's business functions. And this organizational chart is for the board's 2003-2005 legislatively adopted budget in the 2005-2007 governor's recommended budget as follows.
Mr. Washington, let's stop there.
Okay.
For a moment. I have a question for you about the organizational chart. In the governor's recommended budget, there's a reduction of support staff by one FTE receptionist, and the I'm looking at this document now.
Madam Chair, I think that's probably not in the governor's recommended budget, but part of the 10% reductions that each agency is was asked to provide to the subcommittee.
That's correct. That's correct. Thank you, Mr. Wilson. And looking at that 10% reduction and how you have characterized what would be the impact of reduction, I'm reading here that the board has only one receptionist responsible for handling all the incoming calls, etc., and that with a reduction, incoming calls would have to be handled solely by an automated system, thereby substantially reducing the board's ability to provide prompt information to crime victims, parole officers, members of the public, and other stakeholders. Has there ever been a time in the history of the organization that there has not been a receptionist or support staff to respond personally to the public?
Madam Chair, the only time in my experience that I'm aware that there has not been a receptionist there to take those calls for members of the public and parole officers was when the several members of the staff had gone out on strike.
On the looking at the organizational chart, which position is that?
That position is the receptionist, Pat Ziegler, which is beneath the Office Specialist 1. It's in the Office Specialist 1 column.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisner.
Well, we have a break. Mr. Washington, for my information, thank God I haven't been involved with this before. Could you tell me a little bit about what the administrative review back on page 4? Is that a strictly administrative, you're just looking at rules and regulations, or are you actually dealing with them?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisner, how that process works is that each offender that the board makes a decision on and impacts that offender has the right to appeal the board's decision through their administrative review process. And what the offender would do is submit a request to the board explaining how the offender felt the board violated the law or its administrative rules or the state and federal constitutions by the decision that it made. The board would look at the offender's request and would respond to it by looking at its rules and the law in effect at the time that the offender committed his or her offense and respond to his request, indicating either how the board followed its rules in the law in effect at the time that offender committed his crime and its initial decision was legally sound, or by amending its decision and finding or pointing out or agreeing with the offender that he had pointed out correctly that the board did violate its rules or did not follow its rule or law in the time that was in effect at the time he committed his crime, and we would change our decision from that point.
Madam Chair, follow.
Certainly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Washington, so I'm assuming that the budget cost there is you're hiring lawyers that overlook the $877,000. So I know that's not all just 1.25 FTE. That's must be your other services.
Madam Chair and Representative Wisner, that's correct, because most of the decisions that the board makes in this area are appealed to the Court of Appeals and up to the Oregon Supreme Court and sometime to the federal district courts. And the board utilizes the services of the Department of Justice to defend it in those appeals process.
Thank you.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Apologize for being out of the committee. The entire board actually met with me some time ago, and I'm actually relatively familiar with your operations, but there was a figure in one of the staff reports that surprised me. I'm just trying to figure out the correlation between these. That your number of arrest warrants issued averaged about 428 a month. That's in one of the staff reports. And then I'm assuming in a year's time, you probably are issuing arrest warrants in some cases for the same individual multiple times. But in terms of your number of people on supervision, what percentage in a year do you ultimately have to issue arrest warrants for because they have violated their parole or their probation?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, I would refer you to the board's performance.
Please go ahead.
Okay, and that would be in on page 26, dealing with what? Not, excuse me, not 26, but page 30. That correlates with one of the board's performance measures and the recidivism rate of those offenders that we've released out onto supervision, and that plays into the percentage of warrants that we would issue for those offenders. Sometimes it would be potentially more because of the violations that they would be involved in, and that would result in their being having arrest warrants issued for them when they haven't really violated the law, and that would be involved in their absconding supervision. But the number of warrants that the board issues that you mentioned is like 425, and as far as the percentage is concerned of that amount, I would have to get back to you on that. I don't have the actual percentage here. Okay.
Continuing on, Mr. Washington.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. The committee's over on page 8 at this point, and it deals with the program delivery. The agency's internal structure and our program delivery is built around the board's statutorily mandated functions. And the parole, release, and community supervision include the following major functions, and that is to establish prison release dates. The board conducts hearings to determine if and when inmates should be released from prison. Inmates who committed their crimes prior to November 1st, 1989, and that's approximately 1,220 inmates at this time. Those that are sentenced as dangerous offenders, approximately 210 inmates, and those convicted of aggravated murder who are parole eligible, approximately 190 inmates, and of those convicted of murder after October 23rd, 1999, approximately 190 inmates. Those all comprise the list of inmates that the board would conduct hearings with and make release decisions on. And the board conducts approximately 30 hearings per month.
Mr. Washington, I recall that Senator Winters had some questions about the role of psychological evaluations in that hearings process. You recall her?
Madam Chair, yes, I do.
Are you prepared during these hearings to respond to her questions and concerns as a part of your...
Yes, I have. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator Winters' question centered around the cultural competency of the psychologist that the board contracted with to conduct its psychological evaluations, which it uses as part of its factors to make its decision on releasing an offender. The board had each of its psychologists write a letter to the board on that issue, which I have here for the committee members' review.
If you could make that available to staff and for the committee, I would appreciate that.
Okay. All right.
And we will review the information.
Okay.
And I know that Senator Winters is listening, and we just want her to know that we've not forgotten the issues that she's brought forward, and we're getting those issues and responses on the record.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Washington.
All right.
Senator Devlin.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. On this first paragraph here where you're describing dangerous offenders convicted of aggravated murder, et cetera, The first item on there is the 1,220 pre-sentencing guidelines inmates prior to 1989. Could you provide the committee not identifying, you know, all 1,200, but could you identify for the committee, not here today, but what the primary offense is for what those individuals are convicted? My guess is that, as we've talked about, anybody that is still in an adult correctional facility with pre-sentencing guidelines, 1989, is a very serious offender.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, that's correct, and I could...
I'd just like the committee to see that, because I've had some of these discussions in my caucus, and I want them to see who these 1,220 people are.
Okay. All right, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the next paragraph under the board's program delivery is to approve the Department of Corrections transitional release plans and impose conditions of supervision for all felony offenders that are being released from state prison and county jails under the jurisdiction of the board. The board issues approximately 480 orders of supervision per month. The next item is that the board notifies victims and stakeholders of hearings and offenders' releases from prison or jail. The board notifies crime victims and law enforcement of board hearings and inmate parole releases or release dates. There are approximately 6,000 victims that are open and active cases that the board is providing notifications and victim advocate services on. The board averages approximately 570 notifications to victims and stakeholders per month.
Now, Mr. Washington, as you lose that, if you were to lose that position referenced earlier, which is a position tied to providing services to victims, tell us what your heartburn is around that piece.
Because, Madam Chair, members of the committee, because it is part of the board's mission and our main motivation is to protect the public and provide access to victims, that would be a major impact for how the board does its business and how it would provide those services to the public and satisfy its statutory function, because that's part of the board's statutory function is to provide that information to victims to let them know and give them access to our hearings and our decisions on the offenders that have impacted these victims' lives. And if the board were to lose the position of its victim specialist, that would severely impact our ability to do that, and I think it would be a major disservice to victims throughout the state of Oregon.
I certainly agree. Please continue.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The next item is dealing with the issuing of arrest warrants for those offenders who have absconded supervision or who have violated their conditions of supervision or who pose a danger to the community. The board issues arrest warrants for felony offenders who have absconded parole or post-prison supervision or who are in violation of their conditions of their supervision and pose that public safety risk. And the number approximately of warrants that the board issues per month is 435. The next item is that the board imposes structured sanctions for offenders who are in violation of their conditions of supervision. The board orders sanctions for felony offenders who violate those conditions of both parole and post-prison supervision. And after a violation is committed, the board evaluates the appropriateness of the offenders remaining in the community. And if it decides that the offender should remain in the community, it imposes a sanction on that offender to protect the public and meet the offender's needs. And the board orders and reviews an average of 325 sanctions per month. The next item is that the board monitors, adjusts, and discharges an offender's status on supervision. The board discharges felony offenders who have completed their term of parole or post-prison supervision And when the board does that, it issues a certificate of discharge, which is then forwarded to the offender and to the community corrections officer. The board issues approximately 260 discharge orders per month. And the next item in the board's program delivery is our administrative review. The board responds to inmates or offenders' appeals and inquiries. The board responds to the administrative and judicial appeals filed by felony offenders who are asking for a change or a review of board's decisions. And the board's administrative review process is the first step prior to the offender submitting an appeal to the Court of Appeals. And oftentimes the board is able to resolve an offender's concern at this administrative review level, which saves the state money from further legal appeals. And the board responds to an average of 25 administrative requests per month. The next item is the legal and administrative support. The board develops, monitors, and updates policy and administrative rules. We also adopt administrative procedures and roles in accordance with the statutory and policy changes and communicates changes to the board's interest groups, which include such stakeholders as the Department of Corrections, community correction offices statewide, the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors, and the Sex Offender Supervision Network. The administrative support includes business and personal services, records, data, and automation, management, and customer service. The board's service support is the backbone of our agency. To support the functions of our agency and the operations of the board's legally mandated functions and to operate as a state agency, these support functions include the personal management of the 14.75 full-time employees, the budgetary and fiscal affairs, record keeping of approximately 27,000 inmate and offender files, management of our agency's automation and information systems, and the ongoing training to the Department of Corrections agencies in response to public, media, and inmate offender inquiries regarding agency documents, information, and processes. Looking to page 10.
Before we go there, again, looking at the detail in the 10% reduction to the governor's recommended budget, one of the reductions would eliminate a hearings officer position and transfer responsibility for conducting parole violation hearings from the board to county community corrections agencies. Can you comment here on what is the capacity in the community to take up that role, to take up that responsibility?
Madam Chair, members of the community, I think that it would be very difficult for community corrections to take up that that load if the board were to eliminate its hearing officer and ask that they do that.
How many hearings, just so that we have a better feel for what the workload is now and what workload would shift, what kind of numbers are we talking about?
Madam Chair, the number of hearings that the board, that the hearing officer conducts is about 5,000 each biennium.
One hearings officer, not one hearings officer.
Yes, our hearing, excuse me, in the counties as well.
Okay. But again, by eliminating one hearings officer position, that would be how many hearings shifting to county community corrections agencies?
I'm not sure that specific amount. Madam Chair, I've just been informed that our hearing officer conducts about 1,800 hearings a biennium.
Okay. It's helpful to have that ballpark. You have a good bench sitting behind you.
Yes.
Okay. Moving on. And let me check in here. I know that we have at least a couple of people who've been invited to testify, or that you wanted to testify on the record.
Yes.
And one of those people just stepped out of the room.
Okay. He's talking to Senator Devlin out there.
Okay. All right.
Madam Chair.
I know he has a time constraint. I want to get to him. But let's go ahead and address the...
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. The next item in the presentation is page 11, and that would be the performance measure overview. Mm-hmm. The Oregon Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision approved performance measures for 2003-2005. Are briefly described below, and the link to the Oregon benchmarks is benchmark number 64, which relates to adult recidivism. The percentage of parole adult offenders convicted of a new felony within 3 years of initial release. The state target is 28.8%. The 2003 benchmark performance report to the Legislative Assembly indicated that adult recidivism remains in the 30% range, with little change since the mid-1990s. And I think, Madam Chair, members of the community, this is a good time to reference the article that you forwarded to the board that was in the Oregonian today regarding the parole system's ineffectiveness and halting rearrest. The study in this article indicates that the statistics used for this study were based on data from in 1994. And if you would look at the board's the current percentages as found in the board's performance measures on page 30, you will see based on the data, and this is referencing the matrix inmates, that looking from the year 2000 and moving forward, each year the percentage of those offenders that are recidivating are going down. In 2000, our data showed that there was 12.4% of those offenders who were percentage of offenders released that were convicted of a new felony within 3 years of their initial release. And then in 2001, that percentage went down to 10%. In 2002, 8.75%. And in 2003, it was 5.3%. And when you are distinguishing between the parole system and the post-prison supervision system, where the offenders serve a period of time and they're released without any decisions made by the parole board, the rate of rearrest in Oregon in the recent years of the data is showing that the rate for those that were released based on a decision made by the board is much lower than those offenders that were released on to post-prison supervision and went on to be rearrested for new criminal activity. In the performance measure overview, the board has seven performance measures that were linked to, that are linked to four agency goals, and they tie directly to our mission. The board has a mix of measures that not only relate to the major responsibilities of the agency, but include efficiency and outcome-oriented measures. The board has established a performance measure for each statutory function, which is an indication of how effective each major function is being performed. The development of the governor's recommended budget is built around the ability to perform the board's statutorily mandated functions. Many of the board's performance measures are new, and the current collection of the data does not establish a long-term baseline to measure against or establish optimal target goals. The board is hoping to establish a good baseline upon the completion of 4 years of data. for the fiscal year of 2003-2004, the board met four of the seven targets established for each measure. For two of the targets not met, the outcome is dependent upon the board and other governmental agencies' collaboration. Involved in a system approach to providing services, the board is actively working with these agencies to improve the services as a system, which should deliver the desired results in meeting performance measure targets. And the four measures where targets were met include percentage of the matrix inmates applies to offenders whose crimes were committed prior to November 1st, 1989. The dangerous offender sentenced by the court as a dangerous offender pursuant to Order of Revised Statute 161725 and Order of Revised Statute 161735, and aggravated murderers that were convicted of a new felony within 3 years of the initial release. This measure is a subset of the recidivism data, which is part of the Oregon benchmark number 64. Moving to page 12, the percentage of warrants received by the board in which the warrant was issued within 5 days. This measures the timeliness of the board in collaboration with community corrections to issue a warrant for an offender in violation of parole or post-prison supervision. The next performance measure is the percentage of revocations for offenders who violate the conditions of parole or post-prison supervision. And this measures the effective use of sanctions in decisions by the board for offenders who violate parole or post-prison supervision. The next item is percentage of expiration of post-prison supervision or parole orders that have been completed and mailed within 5 days of an offender's discharge from parole or post-prison supervision. And this measures the board's timeliness to issue expiration orders upon discharge of parole or post-prison supervision. The measures where the three targets were not met include percentage of offenders being released from prison where the board's order of supervision has been received by the community corrections office on or before the offender's release from prison. This measures the board's ability to issue parole or post-prison supervision orders prior to an inmate's release to the community in collaboration with the Department of Corrections and Community Corrections. The percentage of active registered victims for which the board has an accurate point of contact for notifications.
Mr. Washington, let's go back to the previous measure just for a moment.
Okay.
Can you comment on why the targets were not met?
Madam Chair, are you referencing the
25500-02?
Okay. There are, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the factors that are involved in the board's having its order of supervision received relies on the information being the research and the investigation in the field being completed in a timely manner and that information being provided to the board where we could then look at the information as to where the offender is going to be placed and establishing what conditions we feel are appropriate for those offenders that are being released. And so many times the board is relying on information being provided to us in order for us to perform our function, and that is in issuing our order of supervision. And so in working in conjunction with, in collaboration with the Department of Corrections and Community Corrections, we have established a process that is making that the ability for us to meet this measure a lot more possible. But it was an involvement in working through that process in the collaboration within the three agencies, the board, the Department of Corrections, and the Community Corrections, to get a process that fit everyone's within the system that each agency had in order for us to comply with that in a more efficient manner.
So within that, within what you're saying, is that describing a workload issue? Workload, inadequate staffing,
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would it partially would be a workload issue, but it would be more just the collaboration of the staffing in each agency being able to work more efficiently together in order for the board to be able to meet its performance measure in that area.
Madam Chair, just yes. Real quickly to put some perspective, the target in 2003 for this was 95.6%. The agency had a actual percentage of 94.4, so it wasn't too far off mm-hmm. the target.
Okay.
And that was on page 19, if you
that's
a little more detail.
Okay. Please continue.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, member of the committee. The next item is the percentage of administrative review responses completed and mailed within 60 days of receipt of an inmate offender's administrative review request. And this measures the board's ability to respond to inmate offender administrative review requests in a timely manner. Proposed changes in the measures for 2005-2007 include the addition of a customer satisfaction measure, which the board will develop upon receiving finalized customer service reporting guidelines from the Oregon Progress Board. And the board's 2004 annual performance progress report is attached as an appendix.
This might be a good place, Mr. Washington, to stop and move to the public testimony and then come back to your presentation. And in addition to Mr. Dole, do we have another person?
There are,
person?
I believe, three people signed up. Mr. Dole needs to be first to
okay.
possible.
Senator Devlin, I need to pass the gavel to you for a few minutes. I'll be right back. Okay.
Sure. Safely. Representative Hanson, am I in the room?
With him with a hammer?
And if Mr. Dole would please come forward, I'd like to get your testimony.
If you would please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Dole, and I'm president of Crime Victims United of Oregon. Thank you very much for your indulgence in having me up here first. I have an appointment. I've got to be in Tigard later this afternoon. I'm here to testify before you today as the president of Crime Victims United and the co-victim of a violent crime. On October 21st, 1992, a violent teenage offender deliberately drove his car into my 12-year-old daughter, Lisa, and killed her as she was walking to her grandparents' house after school. In the pursuit of justice for my daughter and other crime victims, I became involved with Parents of Murdered Children and Crime Victims United. In 1983, Parents of Murdered Children founded Crime Victims United to advance the rights of crime victims and enhance the safety of all law-abiding Oregonians by addressing problems in Oregon's criminal justice system. Through the tireless efforts of the founders, Bob and Dee Dee Coons, and many volunteers over the years, most of these victims of violent crime, Crime Victims United has worked with the Oregon legislature on laws to protect the rights of crime victims and enhance public safety. I want to say that it's been my experience over the years. I worked very closely with this board, and I've worked with Mike Washington since he's been a board member and since he's been the chairman of the board, Darcy Baker, who I knew prior to her being on the board when she was with Parole and Probation Department of Clackamas County, and of course I've known Len Hannon since I first came to the legislature. So I know this board very well. The previous board, Diane Ray, who's now a judge in Marion County, I worked with her and Cindy Moore. So we have a good relationship with this board, and I want to say this, that these are public servants that really work in earnest on behalf of the public and on behalf of public safety, and we're very proud to be associated with them. Today, Crime Victims United is here in support of the proposed budget for the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. One important component of the budget is victim services that is provided by the board. Oregon statutes require the board to notify victims requesting notification in writing prior to 1, board hearings, and 2, release from an institution. But in addition to these statutory requirements, this board has devoted their efforts to provide advocate duties for victims and their families within the criminal justice system. Victims are invited to be involved whenever possible in the decision-making process of the board. The board's victim specialist, Debbie Wojciechowski, I hope I got that right, she prepares the victims for hearings, attends the hearings with the victims, and guides them through the board hearing process and debriefs the victims following the hearings. And I've witnessed this, and she does a tremendous job, particularly in this debriefing process. The following article from the 2005 April publication of Parents of Murdered Children and Other Survivors of Homicide illustrates the effect of the board's efforts. And I'm going to indulge you and ask you to ask if I could read this brief story to you, because I think it is a compelling one. And it was written by Mary Elledge, of the president of the Portland chapter of Parents of Murdered Children. The family of Bethy Kern has appeared before the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision 8 times. Nothing they can do or say will bring back their 18-month-old daughter, Elizabeth K. Kern. Bethy was murdered by inmate Elvin Reeve when he smothered Bethy while attempting to engage in sexual intercourse. Semen was found on Bethy even though he bathed her after the murder in an attempt to cover the crime. It is very painful for Bethy's family to appear before the board. They must listen each time to Elvin Reeve's lies as he speaks before the Board of Parole. Families relive the murder of their child even without this happening. Seeing Reeve and listening to him still deny that he sexually abused Bethy is a nightmare for this little girl's family. They have been dealing with the brutal murder and sexual abuse for 20 years now. Bethy was murdered on March 2, 1985. Judge Darrell Larson was the district attorney at the time for the case. Each time Reeve comes up for parole before the board, Larson takes the time to write to the board to let them know his concern about inmate Reeve being released. In his last letter, he wrote, in part, "As a circuit court judge for the last 15 years, I know that anyone who suggests that your decisions are easy does not understand the complete context of your duties. However, there are some offenders who have committed crimes which loudly and unmistakably announce their danger to society. I must conclude that inmate Reeve and his crime are one such example." Judge Larson is absolutely right. Not only does the board have to consider the danger to society, they have laws and rules that must be considered so that their decision is not overturned by the courts. The Greater Portland Chapter is grateful for the research and time that the board does and has spent on cases such as Bethy's. They were not fooled by Reeve's lies or denials. Debbie Wojciechowski, victim assistance clerk, was very helpful and understanding with the family. She did her best to consider any need that they might have. Tracy and Robert Baugh and family members who have appeared over the years to keep inmate Reeve from harming other children are true heroes. I have had the honor to tell their story for the last 3 hearings. The pain each of them experience as they go into each hearing is evident. They always bring a picture of Bethy. There is not a time that it does not take my breath away. Those who have faced the murder of a small child know this all too well. All co-victims relive the murder of their loved one. That fact that they want justice and protection for society truly exemplifies their resilience and their bravery. The Baugh-Kern family will be back in 2 years. They have given Bethy a voice. The Greater Portland Chapter is very proud of them. We are also grateful to the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, Debbie Wojciechowski, Judge Larson, and all who have helped bring justice and protection to society. This is just one example of the importance of services provided by this board to crime victims and their families. Now, without giving you a full description, I'd like to cite just two others. The case of Joanne Sherman, who was brutally murdered on a Portland street in southeast Portland in 1984 by Sean Newcomb. This was a real success story, and it was a combination of the board, the family, and the parole and probation officers all combining their efforts together to make sure that Sean Newcomb could not ever hurt another human being. Mr. Newcomb stabbed Joanne Sherman to death in 1984. He was in prison until last year. At that time, he was released over the objections of the board. The board said that he should remain in prison. However, the Supreme Court overturned that decision on a technicality, which I won't go into, but it was a technicality. The family cooperated with the parole and probation people in the county, and they caught Mr. Newcomb in a parole violation. He was brought back in front of the board and is now serving a life sentence and will not be up for parole again. One other case that I was involved in and witnessed was the Raymond Roy case here in Salem. Mr. Roy murdered his brother and his brother's wife, his sister-in-law, Richard and Ruby Roy, in the early 80s. This was at a time before there were crime victims' rights. And they had a young daughter. Her name is Kim White. Kim came to us and asked for our assistance at Crime Victims United in the parole hearing. And Kim, over the years, was, because she was very young when this murder took place, she was not involved in the course because there were no crime victims' rights, had no idea what was going on in the system. She appeared in front of the board. The board decided that Mr. White should not be released, but however, this case again has gone in front of the courts and is being decided as we speak. The board, again, works together with victims' advocates, fostering an open and cooperative environment that encourages effective communications in support of victims. These victim services provide continuity, assurance, and a voice for victims, co-victims, and victim advocates. Crime Victims United recommends and strongly urges you that the legislature approve the board's budget and allow them to continue their services to victims and family. And I thank you very much, Madam Chair, for indulging me and putting me on early. I have an appointment today that I have to make, and I appreciate you giving me this time, and I'll take any questions if there are any.
Let me say again, good afternoon. Thank you very much for being here, for your testimony, and I do apologize for needing to step out before you at the beginning of your testimony.
It's understandable.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
Ginger Martin and Richard Sly.
Yep. Copies of his testimony.
Mr. Dole, did you have copies of your testimony? Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Chair Gordley and members of the committee, I am Ginger Martin, Assistant Director for the Department of Corrections, and I'm here to provide support for the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision and for House Bill 5523. The Department of Corrections and the Board work very closely together in planning for a successful transition of offenders from prison to community and in managing the behavior of those offenders once they are on supervision in the community. The Board, the Department of Corrections, and Community Corrections agencies share responsibility for individuals who are initially sentenced to prison and who will eventually be released. Institution counselors work cooperatively with the board staff and with parole officers in setting the conditions of supervision that detail the requirements that will be placed on inmates after release. The conditions are designed to protect the public in the short term through control of offender behavior and in the long term through interventions aimed at changing the causes of criminal behavior. A good working relationship between the board, the prison, and community corrections is essential in managing this population well. We have that good relationship with the board. Once an offender is released, the board continues to work collaboratively with community corrections agencies and with the parole officers who work in those agencies. For example, the board works with parole officers and hearings officers at the local level to determine the proper sanction when an offender violates the conditions of supervision. Because local resources are used each time a decision such as this is made, it's very important that the board takes into account the recommendations of the local agency, and they do that. At the state level, the Department of Corrections and the board regularly coordinate in the setting of administrative rules and policies. Because in most counties, an officer may supervise a mixed caseload that includes people on parole, people on post-prison supervision, and people on probation, it works best, both from an efficiency standpoint and from a practical standpoint, if the rules that govern that supervision remain fairly consistent. And so we try and work closely with the board as they write rules, as we write rules, so that as much as possible within the laws that guide each of those groups, the officer is dealing with basically the same process. In closing, the Department of Corrections values very much both the hard work of the board and its staff and the close collaboration and partnership that exists between the two agencies.
Thank you very much, Ms. Martin. Comments or questions? Again, thank you for your time.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. Could I ask one question?
Oh, certainly.
Thank you. Ms. Martin, could you explain to me the difference between parole and establishing conditions of release?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for both types of people, conditions of supervision are set at the time of release. And I may not be the most knowledgeable about that. You may want to ask Mr. Washington that question. For folks on post-prison supervision, there are some general conditions of supervision that apply to all people who have that kind of sentence. I think with parole cases, the board has a bit more latitude to develop individualized conditions. However, the board can also and regularly does apply individualized conditions to people on post-prison supervision as well.
Thank you again. Mr. Slott.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you.
I have the original, if I could approach there.
Certainly. Thank you.
Senator Gordley, before I begin, I would just mention in driving over here, if you were still working in this fine profession, it would be a great day for home visits. I don't know that you have that same opportunity. Yeah.
I have something of a memory, having been there.
Senator Gordley and members of the committee, my name is Richard Sly, and I guess based on the folks that you've heard today, at least while I've been in the room, I would represent the field portion of the observations about the Oregon Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. I have the pleasure to serve as the director of Yamhill County Community Corrections in McMinnville and work there and still do to some extent as a parole and probation officer. So I have quite a bit of experience working with parole board members and parolees and the offenders and families and victims that come into that equation. I'm also here in my capacity as the member of the Executive Council. I'm the treasurer of the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors. There's 36 counties, as you know, and 31 community corrections programs. So I think it's safe to say that overall, we supervise, as Ginger Martin pointed out, a mixture of folks, which include probationers and people on parole or post-prison supervision. And I think including some of the higher-risk misdemeanor offenders, we have about 31,000 felony offenders, including the folks that you're looking at under the jurisdiction of this board, and a group of misdemeanor offenders. We're here, likewise, to support the work of the board, and I want you to know that this board and the board previous, with Diane Reyes, the chair, have a very close link to community corrections and the parole and probation offices statewide. They do this in a number of different ways, and I think it's important to point that out. We have a bi-monthly meeting of the Directors Association, and it sort of moves around the state. And in each instance, when the board is invited, they come and give us an update on new administrative rules, changes in their way of doing business. And the second way that this board is very accessible is that once in a while, there's a pretty unusual things that happen with offenders that are violations. Some of them are technical violations with people getting a hot urine sample, or sometimes it's a more serious and worrisome problem. And one of the things that I've noted about the board is they're not bureaucratic at all. We use now an electronic system to transmit warrants from the field to the board. And we've had situation arise on a Friday afternoon at 4:45 where we were able to transmit that warrant. The board took the warrant, reviewed the material, and had it signed off and issued right away, and the police were able to go and pick up the individual. So I want you to know that the board very much is in touch with the community in the field. They also, as it was mentioned earlier, provide ongoing training to field staff to develop and, I guess, certify hearings officers. The process that's used with offenders is called the Morrissey hearing. That's a landmark court decision, Morrissey versus Brewer, which gives due process to offenders on parole or post-prison supervision who have been deemed to be in violation of their terms of supervision. So that sort of training is very helpful. Another part of the board that is helpful for us in the field is that in their rulemaking capacity, they attend to the sometimes sort of complex and sticky issues related to offenders in the field. I'm not a lawyer, but I know that some of the issues have to do with notification of high-risk sex offenders. And sometimes there will be a court case, I'm thinking of the Noble case, where it changes the way we do business. And the board, in their rulemaking process, is very helpful to sort of pass that information along to us in plain, non-lawyer-like language, and then to follow up and answer questions. I would also say, since the implementation of the Senate Bill 1145 and the process of local control, the board has been very helpful to individual counties to help develop rules around our practice that is sort of the county equivalent. We've used a lot of their administrative rules, stolen a few, to kind of guide our practice. So the long and the short of that is that the board makes good decisions. Likewise, there's a difference between the way we do business in rural America versus urban or metropolitan America, and this board has been very helpful to those of us that have different types of resources and a different approach to supervision. I know in some high-profile cases from our county, the board is also, as the chair, Michael Washington, pointed out, very committed to giving district attorneys and victims the opportunity to have input in those hearings. That's not always the case in a large organization or in a statewide organization, and that, I think, is laudable. There never seems to be a logjam in their workload. And finally, I think my other point is I like to see the independence of the board. It's a part of the executive branch of government. It's not connected by direction or supervision to the Department of Corrections, and is able to make independent decisions. That's very helpful. And I should mention as well that the three people that are on the board now, Michael Washington, excellent job by all three of these folks, including Darcy Baker. It's nice to see the governor appointed someone that has expertise in the supervision of sex offenders, which is pretty critical, and she's regarded, I think, as an expert and is really a pretty nice person, too. And having Mr. Hannon on board, I think, offers that broader perspective, and it's nice to have somebody there from Southern Oregon. I think that concludes my remarks, except to say, if you're looking at all of our offenders that are supervised statewide, the people that go to prison because of felony sentencing guidelines in 1989 are the most challenging, most high-risk offenders for reoffense, and the ones that we pay the closest attention to in the community. So it's very nice and it's very helpful to have a parole board that you know is going to be there to help out. So we would respectfully recommend and encourage your committee as well as the legislature to fund this board completely. I guess I'm ready for questions if that's the protocol.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sly, for making it a priority to participate with the committee this afternoon. We appreciate you coming over from Yamhill County. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize to you and the committee and the people testifying. I had to testify on a bill, one of my bills. That's why I was in and out. So I hope I'm not going to ask something that's been asked. Two questions. Is the county support, you know, being adequately funded through the parole board, parole and post-prison supervision board? And the way I figured up, you're only getting paid $50 a hearing. And why only 15 counties? Why would the counties decide to do this? Oh, three questions.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, let me see if I can take those individually. Some of the counties, ours for example, elects to use the option where the board trains our hearings officer. We have two or three folks that do that, myself included, and that for us is a convenience because the extent of our hearings is fairly limited. And because we do that, we enter into an intergovernmental agreement with the board, and they pay us a modest stipend for doing that over the course of the biennium. We think that's helpful. In other counties, the level of parole hearings is substantially greater because of the greater number of offenders. So in those cases, the board has a hearings officer who works under their direct supervision that is skilled in doing this and conducts a lion's share of those hearings. So it's a county or a local decision, I think is a fair way to put it. So that does that touch on your point?
And the adequacy of the funding, Madam Chair. Could you address that, sir?
Do they pay us enough to do that? I think so, yes. I think it's reasonable. The hearings sometimes are relatively brief, and at other times are fairly complex. And so we rely on the board in a complex case to provide some direction. But primarily, those of us that have elected to do that seem to do that fairly well. So is the funding adequate? It seems to be. If you're thinking about taking that away, we're just barely making it on that.
Thank you, Matt.
Was there a third part, sir?
I think we've covered it. I guess for my own information, does Deschutes County do their own?
I'm sorry to say I don't know, but Mr. Ace may know.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sly, and we appreciate your sense of humor as well.
Oh, well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be here.
Mr. Washington, if you'd like to come back. Ms. Gilbert.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Given the time constraints remaining, is there anything specifically that's remaining in the budget, in the board's budget presentation that you would like for me to comment on?
I think we left off with...
We were discussing the performance measures when we left off, and I'm basically completing that section of the...
Let's go to the requested measures for 0507. We had a couple members out of the room earlier.
Okay.
And I just want to make sure that members have an opportunity to look at those, and if there are comments or concerns,
okay,
those get expressed.
All right, Madam Chair, members of the committee, in the requested measures, the board was referencing its key performance measures, which all of the most of the agency's goals is to protect the public and the value in the, of the victim's interests, and reduce the risk of repeat criminal behavior, and ensure legal integrity and value the partnerships of the stakeholders. As we had mentioned, our performance measures dealt with the percentage of matrix inmates, dangerous offenders, and aggravated murderers that were convicted of a new felony within the 3 years of initial release, the percentage of offenders being released from prison where the board's order of supervision had been received by the community corrections office on or before the offender's release from prison, percentage of the active registered victims for which the board has an accurate point of contact for notification of hearings and of offenders' release, and percentage of warrants received by the board in which the warrant is issued within 5 days, percentage of revocations for offenders with who violate their conditions of parole and post-prison supervision, and percentage of the expiration orders that have been completed and mailed within 5 days of an offender's discharge from parole or post-prison supervision, and percentage of administrative review responses completed and mailed within 60 days of receipt of an offender's administrative review request. And then there is a new one, placeholder for customer satisfaction performance measure until the state guidelines are released to agencies. And the board's...
Senator Devlin has a question.
Oh. Okay.
I do note in that one that it says it's an expectation and criteria for all agencies. And I think you might be in a similar position as the Indigent Defense Commission. Who are your clients?
Well, I
assume this would probably be the agencies that you're working with, or the... from some of your work with crime victims, I would guess that could be part of it. But I doubt if you, the clients before you for hearings are going to have very satisfactory...
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, the board has identified its customers as crime victims, family and friends of offenders, and parole and hearings officers and Department of Corrections staff and the general public.
Okay.
So that's, I think that's where we would be going from our customer satisfaction portion.
That was back on page 4 at the beginning of the presentation.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you've got the percentage of active registered victims for which the board is an accurate point of contact for notification hearings, and that's, you know, your target or your performances there are good. From my information, how do you play in the sex criminals release as far as notification? Do you do that, the police? Do you work with the police and put in a, I know in my interim committee assignment on the judiciary, we got into that about how to register them and what, you know, does the community know, and how do you get involved in that, Mr. Washington?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, the board doesn't actually get involved in notifying the community of sex offenders that have been released into the community. That is the job of the community corrections office. The board does play a part in who the community corrections office is able to notify the community on by virtue of the board's designating those specific offenders as predatory sex offenders. And that ability to designate offenders as predatory sex offenders has been impacted by a recent Supreme Court decision
that basically invalidated the board's process and how it designated offenders as predatory, how it operated the hearings that determined that offenders were should be designated as predatory. The court indicated that the board was depriving the offenders of their right to due process and the manner in which it offered those types of hearings before it made a determination as to whether or not an offender was designated as predatory. And as a result of that ruling, the board has explored several different options based on advice from the Department of Justice as to how we could continue with our designation of offenders as being predatory to allow the community corrections to notify members of the community of their existence in the particular neighborhood. And the advice that the Department of Justice has provided to the board is that in order for the board to satisfy the Supreme Court ruling and be able to designate offenders as predatory, we will have to require that each offender undergo a psychological evaluation in order to determine that the offender is presently exhibiting characteristics that show us a tendency to victimize or injure others. Otherwise, the board will not be able to designate offenders as predatory. And if it comes to that the board does have to follow that process, that is going to severely impact how we do business from a budgetary standpoint, because it will, right now, the board is looking at designating, we see 4 to 5 offenders per week that fit the criteria for being designated as predatory sex offenders. And while we're in the process of establishing a new process in light of the Oregon Supreme Court's decision in BLY versus Board of Parole, those offenders are just stacking up because we can't really designate them as predatory until we have the psychological evaluation or others additional evidence to show that they're currently exhibiting those characteristics. So that decision and how the community is notified of these offenders' existence is being severely impacted right now, and it's really important, as I'm sure members of the committee and Madam Chair are aware, with the number of cases that have been in the media recently with young children being abducted and murdered by convicted sex offenders, with their parents and members of the community not having any knowledge that those people are even in the out in the community. So until the board is able to completely the advice that we've been provided with by the Department of Justice is either the statute that defines a predatory sex offender as someone currently exhibiting those characteristics as showing a tendency to victimize or injure others, either that has to be changed or the board is going to have to order psychological evaluations for every offender that is to be designated as predatory.
Thank you for that information, Mr. Washington. Madam Chair, I think that in keeping with our principles of this subcommittee, that we ought to look at how much that is and see if we want to put together a package. I don't think I want to go out and say that, you know, we haven't notified communities because we're waiting to have the psychological evaluation and something happens in our communities. So, you know, we can ask Mr. Washington to expedite what he needs to get or to look at this analysis and get it. I think it might be money well spent.
Let's flag that that item. Senator Devlin, and we have about 6 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And a couple
of
announcements.
I would concur with Representative Wisnett's request in terms of Mr. Washington getting back, identifying what the cost and time frame would be in that. Sometimes when you make an assumption, it's something that you shouldn't do, but
I would assume that that court decision still allows you to pre-identify which sex offenders you would want to have evaluated, right?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, yes, that's correct. And Madam Chair, members of the committee, in the remaining time that we have, I wanted to point out, because it was an issue with Senator Gortley and the Madam Chair and Senator Winters about the affirmative action report based on that the board has, and particularly with the offenders that the board deals with. And in the budget presentation, we have an overview of our affirmative action report. And also attached to that, we have a hearing results summary broken down in race as to how the board decides to parole or decides to defer. Is broken down and how those decisions were done. By a racial distinction, and I think that would be helpful to the questions that Madam Chair and Senator Winters had regarding the affirmative action aspects of the board's decision-making process. Also, and we discussed the priorities, the priority reductions. We discussed that previously, and in phase two of the board's budget drivers, what I've mentioned with the decisions that were made in the recent Supreme Court decision and the predatory sex offender designation and other cases that impact how the board does business, those are also budget drivers that are really important in addition to what the board has listed in its presentation, as well as the environmental factors that are listed here as well. Are there any questions or anything in addition to what's in the board's presentation that the committee or the Madam Chair would like for me to touch on?
Mr. Washington, I think this would be a good place to stop for now, and we can come back and focus on phase two. I appreciate very much your preparation and presentation, and we thank the bench behind you. Mm-hmm. And also please give our highest regards and get well wishes to former Senator Hannon.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Wilson, would you... Well, there's an article coming around to you now, Terrorism's Impact is the title. You may have already seen this in, I think it's the Council of State Governments magazine for March 2005. And again, looking ahead to the time we'll be spending with Homeland Security, I thought this might be a good read to help us get a handle on what's going on in other states. And I know we have some questions around how are we coordinating / collaborating in this state around these issues. And I know that Representative Wisnot will want to take a particular look at this piece. So in addition to that, Mr. Wilson, you have a schedule to go to prison tomorrow.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, I sent an email around earlier that probably staff has read, but plan to leave outside this committee about 9:45.
Okay.
Corrections will provide transportation, visit a number of places within the walls. They do promise to let you out and also to feed you before they let you out. And try to get back around 12:30 to 12:45, and so we're done relatively early. On Monday, OIA is starting.
And I don't, since Sheila does OIA, I'm not sure where the notebook status is. I don't know if phase two was already in their notebooks or not. And in terms of the Board of Parole, it would be my suggestion, Madam Chair, that we bring them back to finish our presentation the day that we schedule work session. Their budget actually is pretty straightforward and shouldn't take too long. And that way, Mr. Washington can finish a presentation on those high points and also address the issue around the sexual the predatory sexual offender issue before work session. I think we can do that rather quickly.
That will work well, and it will give us a chance to look at the information that you've prepared on the psychologist, the psychological evaluations at that piece. In addition, members and Mr. Wilson, I talked with Director Menes today, Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, and he is very, very eager for the committee to spend some time at his shop, at his facility. And so, Mr. Wilson, I'm going to ask you to, again, look at our schedule, which continues to evolve, and figure out how and when we might do that. Again, Mr. Washington, thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Gilbert, thank you. And close the hearing on Senate Bill 5523. And members, we are adjourned.